This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. It's the height of the summer movie season, and while raging robots, charismatic pirates, and wave-riding angels are dominating the box office, three documentary films are quietly pulling in audiences at an unprecedented rate. Spellbound, Winged Migration, and Capturing the Freedmans are all among the top 20 highest-grossing documentaries ever. To put that in perspective, Winged Migration at number 4 has grossed a little over $5 million since April. That's barely a drop in the bucket for blockbusters like Pirates of the Caribbean, but for documentaries, it's a bonanza. The critical and financial success of these films is giving documentary lovers something to cheer about this summer, so if you count yourself in that group, now's the time to grab your popcorn and settle in for an hour of air-conditioned entertainment. Have you been indulging this summer's documentary offerings? What have you seen? What have you liked? Do you have a favorite documentary film? And what makes a good documentary film? Call us. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Now, who would have guessed that this summer's most dramatic and suspenseful movie would be about, well, spelling?
I told the photographer. He was like, "So what are you going to do when you get to Citywide?" I said, "I'm going to win." And sure I did. I won Citywide Spelling Bee. Now I'm going to the Nationals.
That's a moment from the wildly popular documentary Spellbound. Spellbound's producer, Sean Welch, is in Jerusalem for the Jerusalem Film Festival. He joins us now from his hotel room there. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Lynn. Hello.
Sean, I want to start out by asking you the question we just asked our listeners and which we're going to pose to all our guests today, and that is, what makes for a good documentary, do you think?
Well, I think in our case, we've got something that is as suspenseful as any sports competition that we've ever seen. But we also feel that it is a very entertaining film and that it has cross-generational appeal because of the different themes with education, the American family, the human spirit, and the American dream. I think that America now, in the wake of Bowling for Columbine, is feeling much more comfortable about going out to documentaries and seeing them and viewing them as a form of entertainment.
Yeah. Did you know, I mean, on the face of it, a spelling bee, the National Spelling Bee, doesn't sound like riveting material. But did you understand, even before you went in, how riveting it could be? Or did you really, in a sense, discover it yourselves in the process of making the film?
Well, the competition itself was absolutely enthralling, and when Jeff Blitz, who directed Spellbound, was channel surfing one day, he came across ESPN's live footage, and he knew immediately that he wanted to make this his first film. But it wasn't until we actually got into meeting with the families, spending time with the families, that the other themes were then discovered or uncovered.
And how did you choose the eight? There were eight young people, eight kids, wonderful
yes.
adolescents. I mean, how did you find them? How did you choose them? How did you decide who you were going to follow?
Well, it was incredible detective work and sleuthing on the part, again, of Jeff Blitz. He did research after the 98 B, and one thing he looked at was kids who had competed that year and that were still eligible to return in 99. But he also contacted past winners, the Scripps Howard B officials, regional newspapers throughout the country that sponsor regional Bs, and also spelling coaches and tutors. And with all that information, he kind of fancied himself as a Vegas odds maker and began to handicap these kids. He came up with a list of about three dozen, and we began to send letters and make phone calls and wait for responses. And fortunately, there were a number of families that responded positively. And we ended up covering 12, but we show you eight in the final film.
How involved do you get as filmmakers? How involved do you get in the lives of your subjects, in this case, in the lives of these Spelling Bee champions and their parents?
Well, we, I think, became very involved with them, and we as first-time filmmakers wanted all of our kids to go really, really far in the competition, not only because we had a connection with the family, but also it makes for good filmmaking. And we were cheering silently at times, but also outwardly at other times, for our spellers to do well. And I think one of the most touching and also funny stories is when Jeff and I were in the panhandle of Texas and we were with Angela, whose parents don't speak a lick of English. They crossed over illegally from Mexico 20-plus years ago. And when she was at her regional competition, she battled back and forth through 54 sudden-death rounds. And she finally spelled the winning word correctly, and her parents began to sob. And Jeff and I set down our equipment, we embraced, and we began to cry.
So documentarians don't have to be completely objective. Oh, I'm afraid we may have lost. I think we may have lost Sean Welch. So let's go to the phones, and we're talking about documentaries here today on Talk of the Nation. The number is 800-989-8255, and we're hoping that we will be getting our guest back in a moment. In the meantime, we're going to go to the phones and see what you have to say about documentaries. Tom, in Glendale, California. Hi.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Good.
Very quickly, my favorite is still Hearts and Minds, which was an expose as a documentary about Vietnam. Very quickly, what makes those of us who love documentaries or involved in documentaries happy is the multiplicity of access to cable channels, Discovery Channel, History Channel, and an expanded niche. Now we're not just looking at showing a documentary in 12 theaters around the country, but all the other options to get funding and promotion to share this kind of nonfiction theatrical venture and educate the public.
Now, are you a documentarian yourself?
I am involved in it on my off time. I work in finance at a studio, so until I get a documentary on the air, I am nascently a documentary maker.
But you are encouraged to see not only that documentaries are doing well at the box office or as feature films in movie theaters, but you're saying there's a lot more outlets for showing them.
Absolutely. There's grant funding from PBS, from all kinds of groups. Now there are multiple places for multiple voices to get out, and that's helps everyone. It expands it to a more open area for all kinds of people who love to make films which are more subjective and more personal.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Tom. And I think we have Sean Welch back. Do we have you back, Sean?
Yes, I'm here, Lynn.
Oh, good. I thought you'd clicked away there. We were talking about how involved you can get with these kids and their families, and I was just about to ask you if a documentarian can really remain, or does a documentarian have to remain objective, or is it by its nature almost a subjective experience in a way?
Well, I think that you are right, that by its nature it is subjective, and Jeff and I tried to remain, obviously, as unobtrusive as possible in these people's lives, and it helped that we were a couple of unknowns from Los Angeles. But we spent time with them, just the two of us, trying not to overwhelm them, trying to form a friendship with them so that they would feel comfortable opening their doors, opening their hearts and their lives. But certainly by the mere presence of the two of us, some of the situations were altered.
Yeah. Now, did you realize part of what this film is about? It's about the spelling bee. It's about the kids and their parents. But it says so much about this country. And did you have any idea how large the themes could go with this when you began?
Well, we had hoped to tell a much bigger story. We didn't realize, again, until we met with these families, how heartwarming, how compelling, how touching, and even how hysterical some of these stories were. And really, they unfolded before our eyes as we were making the film, and we became increasingly excited as we moved from family to family throughout the country.
You've been traveling around the world with this film, which is a decidedly American phenomenon, which says so much about this country. How's it being received internationally?
Well, I was a little bit nervous about how it might be received here in Jerusalem, and we just finished both of our screenings to sold-out crowds. There were over 400 people attending each screening, and there was standing room only. And afterward, they clapped, and they clapped in such a way that it began as individual clapping, and then it ended in unison. And it was really touching to have them tell me that although spelling isn't something, or at least a spelling competition isn't something that they have here in Israel, that the themes were universal and that they were touched by the film.
We're talking about the art of documentary filmmaking. My guest here is Sean Welch. He's the filmmaker who produced Spellbound. And if you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to go to a caller now, John in San Rafael, California. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was calling in about winged migration, actually. You had asked what makes a good documentary.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, you know, originally I would have told you human drama makes a good documentary, and those were always the documentaries that I was interested in going to see. And funny enough, I went to the theater to go see Spelling Bee and had the times confused, so I ended up reluctantly seeing Winged Migration, and it really changed my idea of what makes a good documentary, because what I found as I was watching it was that this really was very dramatic, and it was just about birds migrating, but I started rooting for the birds, and I had this immense respect for the process they go through, and it really changed my perception, I think, of nature documentaries and kind of something that I'd never pay attention to in nature anyway. So I think what makes a great documentary now is something that changes the way we view the world or just changes our perception of the subject.
And in that film in particular, the photography had so much to do with the effectiveness, I think, of that documentary.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It was just mesmerizing right from the first opening shot with the boy running through the grass, and right away sucked me in. So I really went in, like I said, quite skeptically, because I've never truly paid admission to see a nature documentary before, and I just left completely surprised by the experience that I had.
Did you ever get to see Spellbound?
No, I have not, and it's still playing, actually, very near my home, so I'm absolutely going to see it.
All right, well, it's a very different kind of documentary, but it's also a good one. Thanks for your call, John.
Sure, no problem.
It's interesting the point John makes, Sean, and I wonder, you know, how much your own ideas about documentaries have changed as you've become a documentarian yourself. This is your first documentary, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Although I did grow up enjoying documentaries, my parents gave me a subscription to National Geographic at a very young age, and I was more drawn toward nature documentaries and anthropological documentaries. But really, the Hoop Dreams changed it for me, and also Brother's Keeper. Seeing those two documentaries, again, about human drama, and some script-writing friends of mine have told me, you know, Sean, there are really only 7 scripts in Hollywood, and I countered with, yes, and from 8 to infinity are the documentaries.
Mm-hmm. So what's your next project? Are you already planning another documentary?
Well, Jeff Blitz and I are planning on working together in the near future and, you know, for many years to come. This has become such a fantastically unexpected full-time job, traveling with the film and being with it and trying to enhance the audience experience, that we've been doing this for about 15 months, and we're near the end of that, and we'll probably take a couple months to sleep and then begin focusing on our next project, which is likely to be a documentary.
Now, I couldn't help but wonder if you're going to do a follow-up to Spellbound, because you pulled people into the story of these kids so thoroughly that I'm sure lots of people like myself were wondering, you know, where do they go from here? What happens to them? You know, what's next for these kids?
Yes, well, I can tell you that all but one of the kids that we profile will be entering college this fall.
Oh, okay.
And the one who doesn't or is not going to is still in high school. But he, I expect, will be going to a very prestigious college in the next few years. But we have fantastic relationships with these kids and their families, and we wanted to give them some breathing room now and allow them to enjoy their minor celebrity status since the Academy Award nominations. And then we'll revisit with them in a year or a couple years and see how they feel and see how we feel about it.
I'm glad to hear they all survived, even those who didn't do as well as they wanted to.
Well, I think that this is not so much about spelling, but it's about these kids who realize that applying themselves and dedicating themselves and putting in so much hard work into this one specific task not only helps them immediately, but also helps them in their pursuit for higher education and also for things they'll encounter in later life.
All right, Sean Welch, thanks for being with us. Sean Welch is the producer of the documentary film Spellbound. We'll continue our discussion about documentaries when we return. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Winged Migration, Capturing the Freedmans, and Spellbound are delighting documentary film lovers this summer. 15 years ago, The Thin Blue Line, a documentary about the murder of a policeman in Texas and the subsequent trial, shocked and astounded documentary filmgoers with its suspenseful use of traditionally fictional plotline and characters.
Her original statement, 15 minutes after the killing, a fur-lined collar on the killer. In court, well, it might have been bushy hair. The kid testified that I had a Levi jacket on, which is the same type collar, or basically the same as this. He testified at pretrial that he had a fur-lined parka. She's telling you who killed the man. One person in the car with a fur-lined collar.
That's Randall Adams, one of the subjects of the documentary The Thin Blue Line, talking about the testimony used against him in a murder trial. A Thin Blue Line's director, Errol Morris, has made several other critically acclaimed documentaries, including A Brief History of Time, Gates of Heaven, and Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. Errol Morris joins us now from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on.
Do you think that the Thin Blue Line in some way changed the way Americans understood or thought about documentary films?
I know that it's a film that has been copied many, many, many times and has been influential on how documentaries are made. At the time it came out, there were so many questions about whether this really is a documentary. Does it fit into the category at all because of the use of reenacted material and the use of a music score by Philip Glass? It breaks, of course, with the tradition of cinema verite, of the handheld camera, the fly on the wall, but I believe, yes, it is a documentary, very much so.
I was about to ask you, because we're asking everybody this, and it's one of the sort of central questions of the show, which is, how do you define what a documentary is and what makes a good documentary?
Well, in my more cynical moments, I like to say that the difference between drama and documentary is two zeros. That is in the budget. That you have a lot less money to work with in documentary.
Uh-huh.
But for me, the crucial thing is that I am talking to the real people involved. All of the characters, for example, in The Thin Blue Line are the real guys. The real fall guy, the real killer, the real police officers, the real surprise eyewitnesses. And there is something about the mystery of personality. Who is this person that I'm talking to? Who is he really? That documentary can capture in a way that drama cannot. You have someone talking to you. They're there on the screen. You're looking at them and wondering, is this person lying? Is this person telling the truth? Are they hiding something?
To what degree is it journalism, and to what degree is it an artistic endeavor?
Well, I believe, I guess this is at the heart of what I do, I believe it can be both, that the two in no way are incompatible. You know, I've been told by many people, Thin Blue Line is the movie that got an innocent man out of jail. A man originally sentenced to death for this murder. And I like to point out that the movie brought the case to national attention, but what got him out was my investigation, that I was able to capture on film in these interviews evidence that could be used to overturn this prior conviction. And that's what's so powerful about documentary, if you like. You can go someplace with a camera, you can put it in front of a person, you can record what they're saying, and it can have enormous influence. in this case, writing a terrible miscarriage of justice.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about documentaries, and we're going to go to your calls now. The number, if you'd like to join the discussion, 1-800-989-8255. Our guest is Errol Morris. He's the director of the Thin Blue Line. And let's take a call from Stuart in Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
I just had a comment about this whole documentary thing. I've noticed in the past few years that there's been a growing interest in reality-based TV shows they're putting on, you know, on broadcast networks. And it's just kind of interesting that now documentaries are sort of taking off in movie theaters. And in my opinion, it's high time that this has happened. I've loved documentaries for years, and it just seems to be that there's a public a growing public interest in true stories and reality-based TVs. You see it in bookstores, too. Nonfiction is more popular than ever. A lot of people wonder if fiction is dead, if the novel is dead. I don't personally believe that's true. But you know, it's just kind of interesting that these true stories are so compelling. When they're well-written, they read better than fiction in a lot of ways.
Errol Morris, do you see, I mean, have you noticed since you first made A Thin Blue Line, between then and now, a really growing interest in documentaries?
Well, it seems clearly the case. I mean, the fact that you have this program on today and that you're talking about a whole number of documentary films that are in theatrical distribution is an enormous change. Not to say that there haven't been many influential documentaries in the past, but perhaps documentary is coming into its own.
Okay, thanks for your call, Stuart. And we're going to go to Perry, and he's in Woodside, California. Hi, Perry.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to talk about another documentary that I've seen recently that I believe still out in circulation, called Russian Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a basically a walk through the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia, and as the cameraman goes through the various rooms in the museum, there are hundreds and hundreds, several hundred actors at different points in full costume, appropriate for the period in history in which they're depicting, and their scenes being reenacted and so on. But what makes this movie so incredible is it's an hour and a half movie, and it's all one continuous movie shot. There's no editing, no cuts. It's the start, and the camera goes for an hour and a half through these various rooms. So from both a art and a history point of view, it's amazing, but also for those people who are film buffs, it's a real production marvel.
I've heard of this, but I haven't seen it. It's hard to imagine, actually, before you see it.
It is. I've seen it twice, and it's still hard to imagine. And actually, my understanding is it's supposed to come out on DVD in September, but if you have a chance to see it in a full-size theater, that would be the way to do it.
And it really holds, it must hold your interest if you went to it twice.
Well, it holds my interest. On the other hand, my sister went to it, and she couldn't figure out what was so interesting. She didn't like it at all. So I think it's one of those love it or hate it kind of movies.
Yeah. I think Alfred Hitchcock, maybe either one of you, Errol Morris, you might know this, didn't he with a feature film try doing a film where there was just one shot all the way through the film?
Well, it was restricted to very, very long camera takes, rope.
Right.
Yeah.
But Sukharov, who made Russian Ark,
mm-hmm.
has made a number of what I would call straight documentaries, is really one of the world's great filmmakers.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that, yes, there's a difference between drama and documentary, but I think it's also important to remember that both kinds of filmmaking can have elements of the other, that we can have documentary and fiction and vice versa. I think that was what was so heretical, if you like, about The Thin Blue Line, was that it did incorporate reenactments, if you like, dramatic material in the context of a documentary. But, of course, the other way around is also true. The neorealists who put real people as actors in their movies and who recorded real life in one form or another as part of drama. There is no rigid line that you can draw in the sand that tells you on this side is drama and on the other side is documentary.
All right, let's take another call now. Bishel from Battle Creek, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question from the panelists, which is that if somebody wanted to get into a career in documentary filmmaking, what kind of person are, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to generalize all kinds of people in this profession, but what I'm saying is maybe this can be answered in a negative fashion. What must you not be to have a successful or distinguished career as a documentary filmmaker? Personally, for me, I'm a great fan of documentaries on whatever subject, and that's exactly what I wanted to find out. As somebody who wants to maybe, you know, do a little more with that, I mean, make it into a career or something, if it can be made into one, I just wanted to know that what sort of a, I mean, it's one thing to like something, it's quite another to do it yourself. I just wanted to make sure if I, as a person, was up to this thing, you know, in terms of my personality traits, because I think that would have a big impact on your sustainability and your level of accomplishment in anything. That's my question. And the other thing is, if one does come around to the point of view that one is good enough for something like this, what's the best first step to take in that direction? Thanks for taking my call once again. I'll just take the answer off the air.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Well, I'm not sure that there's any one first step that anybody can take to do anything, because everybody arrives at what they do through some unique path. I know that I often wish I did something other than this. If anything, it's an obsession on my part, and I feel compelled to do it. I think it's a very, very difficult job. Documentaries often take years to put together. In my experience, that to follow a story through, it involves this kind of insane commitment that if you were more rational, you would never undertake in the first place.
What are you working on now?
I've just finished another film. It's my third collaboration with Philip Glass, based on the life of Robert S. McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. It's called The Fog of War.
Uh-huh.
And that is going to be released later this year.
It's so interesting to me that although you say your main purpose in doing it really is the art of filmmaking, I think, you seem to choose a lot of material that really is socially conscious material, for want of a better word.
Well, yes and no. I've done both kinds of films. This is a film, the film that I have just finished, The Fog of War, that has been on my mind for close to 10 years. And then I just get to the point, particularly in this case, I got to the point where I felt I had to make it.
All right. Well, Errol Morris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Errol Morris is a filmmaker and the director of The Thin Blue Line, A Brief History of Time, and Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, among other movies. He joined us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Party Girl is a popular indie movie that chronicles the maturation of Mary, played by Parker Posey, from notorious party girl into notorious party girl and librarian. Party Girl was made in 1994 by then first-time writer-director Daisy von Schurler-Mayer. Since then, Daisy has gone on to direct the Hollywood movies Madeline and The Guru. Currently, Daisy is working on her first documentary film called The Nazi in the Closet. Daisy von Schurler-Mayer joins us now from her home in Brooklyn, New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
First of all, tell me a little bit about this film that you're working on. What does the title refer to?
It refers to a painting in my mother's closet. What happened is in 1987, our family got, or she got, a letter from a high school class in a small town in Germany, and they were researching the Holocaust in their town, and they wrote her and said, "Why did your grandfather do the things that he did to the Jews?" Which was really a shock, because she had been told that he was sort of senile during the war, and although she knew he was a Nazi, she thought, or at least she was led to believe that he was kind of noble and mentally ill and greeted the Americans with a sword saying he was fighting for Prussia. So when we got the letter, also my father's Jewish, so we were all pretty upset by it. And my mom had inherited all these portraits and paintings from her German family. And I said, "Are you know, is any of them this guy?" And she said, "Yes, you know, that's him over there." So she burst into tears and took the painting off the wall and put it in her closet. And it's still there. Nobody sort of dealt with it. And then a couple of years ago, she died, and my sister and I kept talking about it and thinking that this was sort of unfinished business. So we decided it was time to take him out of the closet.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking, this is the kind of subject matter that a lot of people would prefer not to take out of the closet.
Particularly when you're a Hollywood filmmaker.
Yeah. I mean, didn't the nature of this subject matter worry you at all in terms of taking it on as a documentarian?
You know, it's just something we both felt uncomfortable about our whole life. Like, oh, you're German. Yeah, well, you know, somebody makes a Nazi joke and then you sort of, you say, well, yes, but, you know, my grandfather was a good guy and came to this country. And it just feels like, no, this was the time to, what is our responsibility as the family of a perpetrator? Like, shouldn't we know exactly what he did and to whom and when and, if anything, publicize it? And so that, if the film is a personal story, but to us it's kind of a springboard to a discussion of what is your responsibility if you're the family of a perpetrator.
And what does the rest of your family feel about the fact that you and your sister are making this film?
My older sister's all for it. We've actually been hiding some of the, because he's probably listening, but we haven't told everything that we've learned yet to my dad because we haven't interviewed him yet. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're learning was sort of news to all of us. So even just going through some of the papers, we found stuff, all this stuff with swastikas on it. I grew up never knowing that was even in the house. And clearly my mother was very tortured by it and you know, hid it away while researching the Holocaust and trying to deal with it. So I guess we're just trying to bring it all out into the open and hope that the film will sort of say that everybody should.
And I assume from what you just said that you are interviewing family members, which must be difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we went to Germany and we did some interviews there, and it's been very interesting for me, just the process of making a documentary instead of a narrative film, because you just have no control. So we were excited to meet one family member who was, you know, in her 90s, and it proceeded to be like 4 hours of her opening Ziploc bags and saying, "This is Heinrich, this is Gisela," and just not really telling us anything. But then on another day, we met her son, and he was really helpful. So it's been, you know, it's a different process for me.
Daisy, stay with us. We're going to continue this discussion about documentaries when we come back from the break. If you want to join the discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington. Right now, we are talking about the art and craft of documentary films. My guest is Daisy von Schuller-Mayer. She is the director of The Guru, Madeline, and Party Girl. She's currently making her first documentary, The Nazi in the Closet. Daisy, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that you are making a transition from feature filmmaking to making documentaries. And what's the biggest difference? I mean, what surprised you most in that transition?
The biggest difference is that I'm just incredibly impatient because it's a much more meandering process, and I'm used to the sort of time is money, you've got to go, 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 and everything's very prepared and everything happens very quickly, and it's not this sort of meandering process. But the biggest surprise, I would say, was the similarities in a way. I was kind of disillusioned by it because I interviewed one relative who used to be the mayor of Frankfurt and who has fantastic politics and has been very progressive and very helpful about exposing the crimes of the Holocaust. But he comes off badly on film. He sort of smiles and he shrugs. And when I showed the footage to people, they said, oh, he seems like one of those real closet Nazis. And so that was not my intention, because that's not the truth. And so I go back to the editing room, and I'm using every trick in the book that I would with a bad actor, you know, take out the smile, take out the shifty eyes, cut away, and recut him to make him appealing. And then, you know, put in the voiceover about the memorial he started, and then showed it again, and they said, oh, yes, he's a very you know, he seems like a wonderful guy. So to me, that was disillusioning, because when I see documentaries, I think that this is just the truth, and I didn't realize that it was people using.
So it's how the documentarian shapes the material.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same bag of tricks that I would use, you know, cutting a child actor or you know, something like that. So that's kind of threw me how much power that I have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, that it doesn't completely just reveal itself.
Let's take a call. Dave in Miami, Florida. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
I always wanted to ask a documentary filmmaker how you avoid getting far into an expensive project and shooting $40,000 or $50,000 worth of film and then figuring out my story has no drama. And in your case in particular, how do you avoid the problem of going to Germany, doing your interviews, starting to shoot some film, do some more interviews, and then you have purposely held off on talking to your father and having your father go, oh, yeah, Daisy, I have the documents here that show that this came up years ago. It was all a big misunderstanding, and boom, you have no story.
Boy, I guess that Daisy's really hoping that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I would imagine is the risk, and I've always wondered how, I mean, does every documentarian run down 3 or 4 rabbit holes before they get the great movie, or how does that work?
Honestly, I think the answer to that question lies in where your money's coming from and if you have family money or you don't. Unfortunately, we're very fallen aristocracy here, so we've got no money to, at least initially, we raised a little bit of money just to do the initial shooting that we've done. And, you know, as we continue to raise more money, we have to be vigilant about not... you know, not sort of wasting our time in any one area. So you have to pinpoint things and go for it.
But also, I would think, Dave, and maybe Daisy, you can comment on this. I would think that the subject matter you choose in the first place, I mean, this seems like it would be a compelling story. Are you at all concerned that the scenario Dave is painting is going to turn out, that it's just,
no,
there's no drama, it's not that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, no, exactly. I mean, as a filmmaker, I know what sort of is a good story. And one of the things that I like about and what's awful about the project is that there's no ambiguity about my great-grandfather's actions. He was anti-Semitic, he was a card-carrying member, he was not a victim of inflation or following orders or any of the cliches. So he's clearly a bad guy. So the discussion is clear from the get-go. Now, then it can be, all sorts of things can be open to interpretation, and the people around him we can talk to.
All right. Thanks for your
call. It's clear.
Thanks for your call, Dave. Yep. Let's go to Jackie. She's in Kent, Ohio. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. I wanted to tell Daisy that you actually came closer to being a documentarian earlier in life than you might have thought, because when I saw Party Girl for the first time, I thought you had been looking in my window. I started out going to clubs, hanging out with gay guys, and I ended up working at a library wearing leather miniskirts and thigh-high boots, and it was just uncanny. And I thought, oh, I wish I could tell this woman. She caught my life on film.
Wow.
It was just, I sat there and laughed. I laughed till I had tears in my eyes, and I wanted to say thank you.
Oh, good. We interviewed a lot of librarians, so maybe it was our research.
Well, I'm told that people say, you worked at a library, you dressed like that. And I'd say, didn't you ever see the movie Party Girl?
All right, thanks for your call, Jackie.
Okay, thank you.
You know, we have a clip from that. Maybe we can play that right now. This is Parker Posey in Party Girl.
You showed no respect for me or for the library.
That's not true. She was very into that library. She lent me a book from there on body piercing.
That's nothing. Look, she set up my whole collection by the John Dewey system.
Melville.
Yeah, and I redid it so it was by beats per minute. You know, with the other stuff?
Cross-listed.
Yes, cross-listed.
That's Parker Posey in Party Girl. And
actually, my mom played the head librarian in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so...
You've used your family before in
yes,
film.
Exactly.
That's great. Let me just ask you, this is their first documentary now that you're working on, this film, The Nazi in the Closet. And I'm wondering, first of all, as you're doing this, is there any filmmaker, particularly documentarian now, who's really influenced you in the work you're doing now?
That's interesting. I mean, I love Barbara Kopple, like American Dream was just a stunning film, and Harlan County and those, but I love all of them. I mean, I think that it's interesting that the reality television seems closest to those sort of Frederick Wiseman, like, you know, really real life things, and yet now it's gotten all sort of skewed. But so that's interesting.
And just one more thing. What do you, we're going to ask you what we've asked everybody, what do you think does make a good documentary?
I think personal stories that are universal. I mean, at least with ours, you know, this is a much broader discussion of what's the responsibility of somebody related to a perpetrator, and that crosses cultures and countries and all sorts of, has all sorts of applications to it, but we're jumping off to it from our story. So I think when they're provocative and ask a lot of questions as opposed to teaching, I get a little, my eyes glaze over if I feel like I'm being lectured. And I think also with capturing the Freedmans, you don't know, you know, you come out of their, you know, heated discussion. It's not sort of spelled out for you.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Daisy.
That's great. Thank you.
Daisy Van Schurler-Mayer, she's the director of The Guru, Madeline, and The Party Girl, and she's currently making the documentary The Nazi in the Closet.